Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poriza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
An estimated 2 million people filled the Sab'een Square of the Yemeni capital to commemorate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, or Maulid. Supporters reaffirmed their pledge of allegiance to Islam and its holy prophet while condemning Western nations. They believe the West engaged in a campaign to desecrate Islam and hurt Muslims' feelings. The leader of the revolution, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, delivered a speech to supporters, praising them for their large attendance. He expressed the birth of the Messenger of God ushered in righteousness, salvation, and light for humanity at a time when the entire world was in a state of darkness. In his words, the Western world and its allies are spearheading corruption and misleading mankind away from God and his prophets. He also advised the West and the Saudi-led coalition to end their war and blockade on Yemen.
If the coalition aggressors are keen on continuing their blockade, aggression and occupation of Yemen, they should know it comes with severe consequences. Our dignified people possess a wide range of powerful means, the first of which is our faith in Allah, our high morals and principles, and our just cause. This gives us the full conviction that with the support of Allah, we will be victorious.
The 2023 birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes amidst peace negotiations between the Saudis and Ansarullah officials, aimed at ending 9 years of war and restoring stability in the region.
The Maulid is one of the most significant events which takes place every year to show how much Muslims in Yemen cherish and revere Islam's prophet. They are chanting Labbaik Ya Rasulullah, which translates to, "We are here to serve you, O Prophet of Islam." Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Workers from the now-defunct flag carrier Alitalia met in front of the Ministry of Labour in the Italian capital on Tuesday as part of an action called by the country's base union, CUB. Unionists have been demanding consecutive governments to reinstate thousands of Alitalia workers who have been left in the lurch following years of mismanagement and state-backed rescues. In October 2021, the 74-year-old carrier Alitalia made its final flights, marking the end of an era for Italy. The airline has been replaced by the new national carrier, ITA.
We do not think that under the current crisis the government would be able to redeploy us externally. It is paradoxical that while I'm talking, the government is hiring workers from outside for the three new companies Alitalia has been split into.
The new national carrier ITA has only hired around a quarter of the estimated 10,000 Alitalian employees. Alitalia workers have been feeling betrayed by Italy's largest trade unions.
The man you've seen over there is a unionist. When he was hired by Alitalia, he was just a basic pilot. After ITA replaced Alitalia, he became a medium-haul captain, and soon after, a long-haul captain. Practically, the union he works for has sold Alitalia and our contracts off, and coincidentally, he obtained personal gain for that.
The deal, which led to the formation of the new airline company ITA, also called for slashing the number of airline slots at Rome and Milan airports. Italy's government has recently sold a minority stake of the successor of the country's flagship carrier Alitalia to Germany's Lufthansa. However, the European Commission has not approved the deal yet, a decision that has left the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni puzzled.
I'm afraid the EU only wants to transfer more Italian slots to Germany's Lufthansa. Having said that, the deal is not valid, as there is no discontinuity between the old and new national airline. An Italian judge has ruled the position of Brussels on the deal non-binding, and us workers should be rehired.
Former Alitalia workers believe that Brussels has been planning for years to slim down the European airline market to only three major players, British Airways, Air France and Lufthansa. Max Civili, Rome.
When the name of the Jenin refugee camp is mentioned, the first thing that comes to mind is a stronghold for resistance against the Israeli occupation. It has long been seen as the center of Palestinian resistance. Created in the aftermath of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands in 1948, the Jenin refugee camp was established in the early 1950s in the north of the occupied West Bank. The camp is less than half a square kilometer, according to the United Nations. It's home to almost 12,000 residents.
Jenin refugee camp is a great part in our occupied homeland, Palestine. We're speaking about fighters and resistors. We're speaking about a great popular incubator. We're speaking about brave young men as if they are coming from another planet. They have their own necessities of steadfastness. They have a great ability to fight this Israeli occupation. Different components in their life have led to this determination. First, their ancestors were forced out of their towns in 1948. And second, they're still holding to their right of return.
In 2002, during the Second Intifada, Jenin refugee camp was the scene of one of the deadliest large-scale raids by the Israeli military. 60 Palestinians were killed and 250 others were wounded, while hundreds of homes were completely destroyed and more than a quarter of the camp's population were displaced. More than 20 years later, it seems the battle is not over. Last July, Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, but this time, the heavy clashes and exchange of fire forced the Israeli military to retreat in 2 days, leaving 12 Palestinians killed. The military said then the main aim of the operation was targeting Palestinian fighters and capturing their ammunition. Palestinians say Israel had committed war crimes in the refugee camp in an effort to prevent future resistance and bringing down the Jenin Brigade, the newly formed resistance group that's comprised of fighters from different Palestinian armed groups.
What really unites us here in the Jenin refugee camp is not the Palestinian groups, but what unites us is this refugee camp and family closeness. We all live here as one big family. We stand together against the Israeli occupation and against anyone hostile to us.
This is how those resistance fighters think. They are young men living in the camp. I can describe each one of them as a phoenix. They're brave young men insisting on the challenge with simple equipment, personal pistols, explosive devices, and they caused the Israeli occupation great losses.
Israeli military used drones, bulldozers, and hundreds of troops in its army operation as regime troopers hunted down fighters who had grown increasingly bold. Israeli officials thought the regime's military would succeed in breaking the safe haven of the camp. However, they were wrong.
During the Al-Aqsa Intifada, resistance was strong in the refugee camp. The camp has so long been a center for the resistance fighters. With the accumulations, all the raids and destruction and killings establish a struggle in the camp, a non-stop struggle. This means a generation lives and a new generation comes. They are people who reject humiliation and reject all forms of oppression. The residents know the path has always been thorny and difficult, but that's why the people of Jenin will always remain their spearhead in the face of the occupation.
Not only for its residents, but for all the Palestinians, the refugee camp with its warren of alleyways and dilapidated buildings adorned with banners bearing the portraits of martyrs will keep Palestinians recalling their pain and their long history of resistance and fighting. Despite the non-stop Israeli operations in the Jenin refugee camp, the camp continues to be considered a symbol of Palestinian armed resistance. Residents of the camp argue that the latest killings and destruction have not only failed to weaken the Palestinians' resolve, but also helped to increase their resistance and steadfastness. Mona Qandil, Occupied Jenin Refugee Camp.
the Muslim world has dealt with its fair share of natural disasters over the years, but few would have expected to see the sheer scope of devastation caused by a week of horror across North Africa. Earthquakes, floods, and natural wildfires consuming everything in their path and laying waste to the environment around them.
The first disaster was the horrific earthquake that hit Morocco, a 6.8 magnitude quake which struck at around 11 p.m. local time on the 8th of September. Aftershocks followed on Wednesday the 13th, temporarily hampering rescue efforts there. At least 2,800 people were killed and over 300,000 people remain affected. 1 week on and the humanitarian needs remain incredibly great there. Then there was Storm Daniel, which crashed down on Libya, leading to the collapse of two dams in the city of Derna. The United Nations said in a report released on Sunday that the death toll from the devastating floods that hit that Libyan city, well, that sits at around 11,300 people, although those figures are disputed, with at least another 10,000 people who have still remained missing there. Aid workers fear disease and other crises loom on the horizon, and that will likely add to the toll.
Moroccans continue to live in fear of the inevitable aftershocks while trying to dig through and recover the bodies of the many thousands still missing.
It's God's will. I was in the kitchen with my daughter-in-law while both my husband and my son were sleeping. When the roof fell on them, they were killed, trapped under the rubble, and nobody could save them. It was God's will.
The violent storms which battered Libya could have been more costly in human life than the tragedy in Morocco. As an entire city, Derna, was overrun, thousands again died in the raging waters, with some claiming the death toll could reach as high as 20,000.
We took the families from the first floor to the fourth floor, and then from here we saw the buildings drift. And we saw Derna completely immersed. In just 10 minutes, the city became submerged. At 5:30, as light came, Hamza and Malik went down to inspect the street, and they told us to come down from the second floor to the C Street and not to go out to the side of the valley. We went down and saw a terrifying sight. People are dead in the streets, cars are destroyed, and homes have collapsed.
The wildfires of Algeria have thankfully been less costly, with no reports of fatalities surfacing. This was the exact same region hit with fires in July, causing the deaths of at least 30 people. Despite these hardships and the immense trauma caused to the victims, these Muslim-majority countries consider these calamities a test of faith and endurance, a natural part of this life.
All the Egyptian people offer their condolences and express their grief to the people of Libya and Morocco. We are offering any assistance that we can provide. Egypt already sent support because the Egyptian people and military are willing to show solidarity with people all around the world, not just Arabs.
As the rescue efforts continue, Muslims across the globe have been sending not just charity, but their prayers too, in the hope of sending strength to the people most afflicted with these biblical-style disasters.
The first days of fall in Iran coincides with the reopening of schools after a three-month-long summer vacation. It marks the start of learning, finding new friends, and getting to read new books. Other than that, students say coming to school paves the way to reach their goals and dreams.
We all have goals that we must strive for. Coming to school is one of the steps that we must take to reach those goals. School provides us with an environment where we can use the lessons studied there to improve and succeed in university. I want to study architecture in university.
They say that even though giving up on their long summer vacation is hard, going to school for them means pursuing their desired future.
It's hard to give up on summer vacation, but I'm doing it to get what I want. I would like to study computer and programming in one of the best universities. I really like this field, and I think as a woman, I can achieve my goals. Why not? We have many women who have studied in the best fields and universities.
Melika is a student who has reached high academic achievements despite her young age. She is a young inventor.
I have an invention that can solve the sensory motor problem of patients with spinal cord injury. In addition, I have worked with various universities and medical students on the treatment of stomach cancer, which has been fruitful.
Iran, a country with high position in scientific rankings, owes many of its achievements to the boys and girls whose eagerness to learn has these days brought them to school. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
Israel has resealed its crossings with Gaza for the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement. There is pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza, and the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing in southern Gaza will remain shut until Tuesday. The closure of the crossings will only increase the suffering of more than 2 million Gazans who have been under a crippling blockade since 2007. The impoverished coastal sliver already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Experts say that sealing the crossings during Jewish holidays will further complicate the situation and is part of Israel's racist policies against the Palestinians.
We strongly condemn this outrageous move. Israel uses Jewish holidays as a racist excuse to make the people of Gaza suffer and deprive them of their most basic rights. The goal of closing the crossings is to further tighten the blockade, destroy the economy, and to keep the people of Gaza as prisoners in a big prison.
Every year, the apartheid Israeli regime seals the crossings with Gaza for an average of 100 days for Jewish holidays and other occasions, while keeping its crossings with Egypt and Jordan open on the same occasions.
Israel has systematically closed the border crossings between Gaza and Israel, Erez and Kerem Shalom, which has inflicted more hardship and more burdens on the Gaza community. In the beginning of the Jewish holiday, that they close the border crossings with the Gaza Strip mainly, and they keep it open with other areas, like they keep their border crossing open with Egypt, with Jordan.
Experts believe that only the complete lifting of the inhumane Israeli siege and the permanent reopening of all crossings can end the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the tiny coastal territory.
Israel is suffocating the Gaza Strip with its inhumane policies. We demand the full lifting of the blockade and the permanent reopening of all crossings. Israel aims to harm the people of Gaza, including patients and workers, as much as it can, under any pretext it can find.
Tel Aviv's racist policy during Jewish holidays is considered by many as a grave violation of international laws and norms. Israel says that it will keep the crossings with Gaza sealed during Jewish holidays for security reasons. But human rights groups reject Tel Aviv's argument, asserting that such measures are only aimed at tightening the blockade. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Iraq started its war on Iran 43 years ago today. In the beginning hours, Iraqi bombs rained down on military bases and airports of the Islamic Republic. Within a few hours, a retaliatory operation was planned by Iran's air forces, codenamed Kaman 99. A gathering was held in Tehran on Saturday to mark the anniversary of this operation during the Sacred Defense Week.
The Air Force, as a force with rapid reaction capacity, intervened in a critical situation and bombed the enemy's bases. The experts in the world believe that our Air Force is not capable of confronting the enemy, but 140 airplanes carried out this operation, along with other airplanes that took pictures of the enemy's headquarters.
Iraq deployed 192 warplanes to attack 10 bases and airports on the first day of the war. But Operation Kaman 99 destroyed Saddam's ominous dream of conquering Tehran in just 6 days.
This operation turned the Ba'athist forces' dream of conquering Tehran in 6 days into a bitter nightmare. After 3 days, the Iraqi Air Force had no ability to confront the Iranian Air Force. And from here, Iranian skies became safe and the ground for the liberation of Khorramshahr was prepared.
Participants in the event also talked about the West's intervention in the war in support of Iraq.
The Western countries supported Saddam to attack Iran with the aim of destroying the Islamic Revolution. Saddam initially attacked the Air Force because he knew how important they were.
This operation and other operations that took place during the 8 years of Saddam's imposed war against Iran show the strength and solidity of the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved by the committed and expert forces of the country. President Shuryun, Tehran.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Every hegemonic currency system has its day of collapse. It is the US itself that sets off the inevitable trend of the end of dollar dominance, which may be what many American strategists and economic pundits are worried about. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Brazil's former representative at the International Monetary Fund, IMF, Paulo Nogueira Bastissa, has told RT, "The dollar-based international monetary system is becoming increasingly dysfunctional, prompting BRICS countries to consider creating their own currency." According to Bastissa, even though the greenback will remain an important global legal tender, the currency can no longer be trusted. Speaking ahead of the 15th BRICS summit in Johannesburg, the Brazilian economist said that U.S.-led financial institutions are not addressing the needs of developing countries. He pointed to growing dissatisfaction among emerging market economies with the way that existing dollar-based institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank work. According to RT, officially known as the New Development Bank, NDB, the organization is a multilateral financial development institution established by the alliance of major emerging economies comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in 2014. The economist noted that the NDB was created by and for emerging economies without the participation of advanced countries and claimed it is more global, south-oriented than the World Bank can ever be. Bastissa said, "We had deliberate intention to have the bank acting in a non-intrusive manner, support the plans, infrastructure, sustainable development in countries without trying to guide them, overwhelm them with rules that are not necessarily the ones that they see fit for their own development needs." Speaking about the prospects of de-dollarization, he stated that the fact that the U.S. has been using the dollar as a weapon to target countries seen as hostile to West has reduced confidence in it. He warned when the United States does what it does by taking advantage of its role as the issuer of dominant currency, other countries are uncertain as to whether they can continue using the dollar as they have been using. Batista insisted that the multipolar world would lead to the reduction of the role of Western currencies. The former IMF executive explained this has accelerated with the use of the dollar for political purposes, for geopolitical purposes, notably now against Russia. According to Batista, BRICS has a role to play in creating its own reserve currency. Russia has already proposed that the new currency be called R5, as the currencies of the BRICS countries will begin with the letter R, that is, real, ruble, rupee, renminbi, and rand. Batista concluded, "I believe that the R5 can be started as a unitive account and subsequently evolve into other steps." Meanwhile, the Korea Times noted the American dollar's dominance on global trade looks to be challenged by the expansion of an economic bloc involving China, according to research by ING. The Association of Five Major Emerging National Economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, represents about a quarter of the global economy and accounts for 41.9% of people on Earth. Bloc representatives are meeting in South Africa. The Dutch bank's analysts Chris Turner, Dimitri Dalgin, and James Wilson wrote in a note recently, "We suspect the subject of de-dollarization might gain some traction this summer when senior leaders of the BRICS nations meet. The economic expansion of BRICS could determine the speed at which it adopts commercial and financial systems outside the dollar sphere, posing certain challenges to the dollar's dominant status as an international currency," they said. Beijing has stepped up criticism of Washington for weaponizing the U.S. dollar over the past year and a half, citing Western sanctions on Russia, including freezing Russian central bank assets, kicking it out of the SWIFT global payment system, and also denying Moscow access to the U.S. dollar. Calls for de-dollarization appear to have gained traction in recent months, such as when Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva openly called for local currency settlements rather than through the U.S. dollar during his China visit in April. Such currency unions are intergovernmental agreements involving two or more states sharing the same currency. Last month, Alexander Bobakov, deputy chairman of Russia's State Duma, said that Russia was spearheading the development of this currency union for cross-border trade among a number of developing nations, according to BRICS information portal. The news is expected to add new momentum to the trend of de-dollarization in the global economy. If the currency is successfully issued, it is expected to drive the depreciation of credit currencies, such as the U.S. dollar, relative to gold in the medium to long term. And that is what Zhejiang Securities said in an August report. However, Reuters reported that a BRICS currency was off the table, citing South African officials. And that is what Reuters and some other Western media claimed. Korea Times added China's currency is becoming increasingly used in trade settlements, international payments, and foreign exchange transactions. For instance, Argentina's government paid its International Monetary Fund debt in yuan gained through a bilateral currency swap plan. In its quarterly monetary policy report recently, the People's Bank of China vowed to promote the internationalization of the yuan, further expand its use in cross-border trade and investment, and develop its offshore market. More economies are accelerating the diversification of their foreign exchange reserves, and this includes adopting currencies from emerging economies such as yuan. ING said, de-dollarization is seen mainly in the central bank's international reserves, as the dollar is being pushed out by a variety of currencies, including the yuan. According to the Dutch bank, the U.S. dollar's share of global forex reserves fell to 58.6% in 2022, hitting its lowest point since data was first available in 1995. The ING report said, looking at the long-term developments, the U.S. dollar seems to be replaced mostly by Asian currencies. The ING said bilateral swap lines with various central banks established by the People's Bank of China since 2009 have been a flagship example that winning the world of the dollar requires challenging its international role in trade invoicing.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
France has been plagued by nationwide protests against systemic racism and police violence. This comes after another unarmed young man of color was killed by police during a routine traffic stop. Now, Paris alone saw over a week of riots against the police killing and the controversial law which police have seized upon to justify what protesters are calling state violence and summary executions. The controversial law and its consequences for minorities in France is the topic of this episode of Your Spotlight. Joining us now for our program is Mahmoud Refat, international relations expert, joining us from Paris. And Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, researcher and political analyst, joining us from Detroit, Michigan. Gentlemen, welcome to the program, to our spotlight here, to the both of you. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe. We've seen minorities in France, sir, screaming racism and systemic violence by police for years, mostly Muslim citizens or those of African descent. Your initial thoughts on how pervasive you think the problem is and what authorities you feel in France have done to address it?
It is pervasive. And according to statistics that have been released over the last several months, dozens of people have been killed by the French police over the last several years. Last year, there were over 20 people who were killed. There were others who were wounded as well. And I don't think the residents of France would be up in arms about this if it was not a serious problem. We saw just 2 months ago mass rebellion demonstrations in several cities, not just Paris, but all across France in response to the brutal police killing of Nahil, who was of North African descent. So I think this is a serious problem in France, and if the government does not address it, it's going to deteriorate even further.
Thank you, sir. And Mr. Mahmoud Refat, welcome to the program, sir. Your initial thoughts on how demonstrators, we know they're taking particular aim at this particular law that came into effect in 2017, the 435.1 of the Internal Security Code, which extends the possibility for forces of law and order to shoot in the event of a simple suspect's refusal to comply. Your initial thoughts on this law that protesters are going after and the fact that it's targeting mostly black French citizens and those of Arab descent?
Well, in order to understand
the French police functioning, we need to go back to the history, to the French Revolution. The French Revolution, which is shaping the face of actual France, was launched severally and with police and security mentality. And from her, and according to that, even cities of France were constructed in order to liquidify or to make easier for police to be liquid in the cities and to surround manifestations. When you see majority of cities, and let's take example Paris, you will find Paris as main circle, main roundabout, which is the center plus the Châtelet, and from here the avenues to go through, and each avenue is to end by another roundabout, and each roundabout other avenues to go through, and so on. This construction of the cities reflect lots of, or the biggest part of the French mentality. I mean, the governance of France since more than 200 years, since the French Revolution. It's to make the police dominant at any time. That means using the force, depending on this force in order to oppress manifestations. And that made big accumulation and big heritage until we reach it today. Well, in 16th, 15th, French police had also big waves of movements and actions that were subject of media. And until today, we are talking about throwing Algerians in the Seine River until today. Something happened more than 60 years ago, almost. But today, it has been legalized. These actions have been legalized by the code itself. The law, and with years, laws, especially under the administration of President Macron, the police was given lots of laws to protect its violence and brutality, and breach of rules and breach of the European Union rules in general. By the way, the European Union has a code of ethics for the practice of the police and has rules to be applied on all European countries, mostly only France, who is somehow outside of this of these rules because of guarantees and protections were given by laws to the French police. Again, the French police, to understand that, we need to understand the whole construction of France and the French Revolution, which shaped the actual face of France we have physically on hand.
Thank you, Rafat. Mr. Rafat, that's a very interesting perspective, and that takes us way back to France's colonial past. Mr. Ezekwe, this IGPN, the Inspector Responsible for Investigating Police Misconduct, released its annual report on use of force by officers. It found last year 38 people died as a result of police action. 22 were shot dead. From those 22, 13 involved cases of someone refusing to comply with a simple police order, most of them Black and Arab descent. Now, there were three such killings the previous year in 2021 and two in 2020. Your thoughts on where this trajectory is headed?
It illustrates clearly that the situation is getting worse for people of color, poor and working class people in France. In regard to the French Revolution, a lot of the reforms that came out of the revolution were eventually overturned. For example, the abolition of slavery was revoked in regard to the occupation of Haiti. And France fought a long war to maintain Haiti as a colony. They were defeated in 1804. Same situation with their colonies in Africa. Algeria, they occupied for over 130 years. In May of 1945, they slaughtered thousands of Algerians for protesting in celebration of the French victory in World War II, but also calling for Algerian independence. During the revolution between 1954 and 1962, over a million people were killed by the French colonial forces. So they have a history of brutal repression. And now with the economic crisis that exists in France, the police are being utilized as the front line of defense against a crumbling state in France, headed by Emmanuel Macron and the prime minister there as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Rafat, we know that France has a whole lot to say about other countries when they have volatile protests, when they're simply riots. There were riots in Iran. The French president called them protests. And now they're having riots in France because of this law. But you see the French, they're not so vigilant when it's taking place on their own soil, how they label it and how they address it systemically.
Well, this is the norm of the international relations. You know, for example, when the United States oppressed severely the movement of Let's Occupy Wall Street, if you remember that, like one decade ago, it was real violence of international law and guarantees of freedom of speech. And despite that, the American media at that time, I'm just giving the example with American here, not only with the French, to show it's worldwide exchange when it comes to this point. At that time, American media did not criticize the American police so much. And the politicians did not criticize the police, the American police, so much, despite this the severe behaviors of the American police. The same in France. While when there is crash with a country, with another nation like Iran, no, anything will happen in Iran will be put in image of the end of the world. While let me give you a direct example. American politicians, French politicians, I mean, Occidental politicians have been talking a lot about Chinese behaviors against Muslims and Chinese persecution of Muslims, etc. Despite, just beside China, in India, there is more horrible and more terrific behaviors and adopted officially by the government of Prime Minister Modi, but India is a good friend and good ally of the West. That's why India almost never mentioned in any criticize of that. So this is the norm in the international relations. When something, if you are my friend, I will close my eyes and I will not say anything about what's happening on your land. If you are not my friend, I will try and I will do my best to use the smallest and most minor things can happen in your on your land to give impression that you are a monster, you are giving up the human values, you are breaking the international law, you are outside of the United Nations regulations and rules, etc. So this is the international relation game, which all experts are, or all specialists of international relations are familiar with today. We no longer focus on that a lot. It's just political announcement, which at the end of the day do not help a lot, neither build a real situation or get real benefit more than to be media propaganda.
And Mr. Thank you, Mr. Rafat. Mr. Ezekiel, and to Mr. Rafat's point, if you put a law in the books that is getting this kind of result, is blasted by rights group and is targeting a specific sector of your society unjustly and disproportionately, why do you allow it to persist?
Because obviously they have an agenda to suppress the African and Muslim and working class communities in France. That is their agenda. And it's the same thing in the United States, in Britain. All these three leading Western industrialized countries have a similar problem with police misconduct and police brutality. It was quite interesting when the rebellions were taking place in France just several months ago in response to the police killing of Nahil. Macron framed the demonstrations as being a result of juvenile delinquency. He accused the parents of those involved in those rebellions as being irresponsible. Rather than address the underlying social problems that prompt these type of unrest to break out in France, I think it's an avoidance on the part of the French government. They do not want to accept that their society is institutionally racist and that the police are brutal, and they need to be disarmed and they need to be dismantled and reorganized. And the same situation is true in the UK as well as the United States.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you, sir. And I want to put that Mr. Ezekiwe's words to you, Mr. Rafat. If Paris, Washington, and London, they proclaim to be the champions of human rights throughout the world, they try to preach to the rest of us what it means to be equal, just, democratic. They try to teach us all about human rights. But when the impetus has to fall upon their own people, upon themselves, upon their own backyard, why do they have such a hard time keeping it clean?
Well, let me just highlight a very important point. There was lots of remarks concerning the French police functioning. That's true. But what is making these remarks to appear so much is the nature of the French society, the history also, which is building the nature of the French personality. The French personality is naturally rebel personality, is not obedient at all personality in front of the governments, in front of the governor. It's not obedient society. I do not want to specify another or compare to another societies, but let's say to generally to the north of Europe, more north of Europe and Scandinavian countries. These countries, for example, when you go there, once the governor, the prime minister or the cabinet of prime minister or the parliament or whatever took a decision and there is a new rule, new law to increase the age of retirement, for example, society will be obedient. There is kind of trust between the society and their governor. While the French specificity in Europe, which is very close to Italian, but more in France, we can notice that French society, not obedient, not that submissive in front of its governor. And that highlights a lot and put lots of light on the reactions of the police, how the police behave in France. So that's why the French police is always mentioned in the news, because also of reactions coming from the French society itself. Me, myself, from Arabic origin, I can confirm, yeah, there is somehow some remarks also concerning the and misconduct concerning the discrimination, yeah, but not as much as it's described. The French police is severe and brutal against all the society, all components in the society. Maybe a little bit more against Arabs or black, that's true, maybe, especially in some areas, in some cities like in Paris, when we go to Paris, some areas were highly populated by Arabs and Africans, Marseille, but this is really minor comparing to the French brutality with against the French manifestations of les Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, for example. They are not Arabs, they are not black, they are real French people coming from French descendancy since hundreds of centuries. And despite that, we saw them being massacred by the police. And we do not have exact numbers of victims, by the way, about victims of Yellow Vests, for example. We do not have real exact numbers. All numbers are showing are highly doubted by manifestants themselves who witnessed that some of their colleagues even were killed. So the French brutality is against all ingredients of the society, unfortunately.
And that's a really interesting point that I want to put to you, Mr. Ezekwe, because it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? For the French personality, Mr. Rafat said, is rebellious against authority in general, and their protests are friendly as a result. But did that come as a result of state violence inflicted upon them by authority to make them rebellious,
or did the state become authoritative due to their rebellion nature? Because in the U.S., you have something completely different. You have protesters out that are victims, literally victims of police violence, and you cannot really say that they caused the police to create that violence against them.
Normally, people will not go out and demonstrate and rebel if there's no just cause for their actions. And the point is well taken. The Yellow Vest movement was met with severe repression. At the beginning of this year, unions and the student unions who had rolling strikes that raised the age of to receive full retirement, that those demonstrations as well were met by vicious police brutality. And they went ahead anyway, the French government, and rammed through the law, even without a vote of the National Assembly. So this does not look good for the French ruling class. And I think that they're becoming more and more exposed. What is going on now in West Africa? They were just ordered to leave Niger. They claim now they're going to pull out. So I think all across the world, people are beginning to see France in a different light, not as the origins or the originators of the French Revolution of liberty and fraternity and so forth, but as a ruling class that is seeking to maintain its hegemony, whether it's in France, in Africa, or wherever else they feel they have national interests.
Thank you. And final thoughts I'm going to put to you, Mr. Refat. You close the program with, if you want to basically track down Mr. Ezekiel's narrative there and yours, it doesn't seem like French authorities have too much care to address this problem.
Well, there have been lots of attempts in order to modify the functioning of the French last two decades, but these attempts were not successful simply as because the government, the state, did not support them. France is very, very, very concentrated regime. And government doesn't support a project, this project will never see the light one day seriously. It will exist on the media, but it will never be applied on the ground. At the end of the day, every single thing in France is in the hands of the governor, of the authorities, the civil society, the NGOs, etc. They exist a lot, but they are exist to express their wishes. But to be applied, it must be adopted somehow officially, on official level. That's why it never been adopted. Meanwhile, the contrary has been adopted, is to give more protection to the police. For this reason, the attempts of making